Welcome to the Hebrew Nation Morning Show, where we discuss the biblical roots of our people and our faith. Linked to Accurate Precious Metals Refineries, our morning show sponsor at HebrewNationOnline.com. Lines are open, so call 503-967-3001 if you would like to join in the conversation. You can also chat with us online in the morning show chat room at HebrewNation.net.
All right. Welcome to the Thursday morning show. And we are in the process right now of getting ready for what's going to be a very quick 2 hours. I recommend to you that you hang on to your hats and that you stick on your seat belts, because of the fact that things are going to get real, real exciting here very quickly. First thing I want to do, though, and this is something that we always try to do, and Gene usually steps ahead of himself and doesn't do it, but we're going to pray today over this show and pray that Abba will have his will in everything that's said and done here. Father, I just thank you right now for the opportunity to do this. I thank you for these 2 hours. I thank you, Father, for the opportunity to spend time with Jim Barfield and with Deanna Dye, Father. I ask you to make every word count that we speak, Father. I just ask you, Father, to lead us along, Father. Show us what you want us to say, what you want us to do, what direction you want us to adopt, Father, because you're the one who knows your plan, and your plan is the only plan that matters. So, Abba, I just thank you right now for that. I thank you for everything that you're doing in the body, Father. I thank you, Father, that the Hebrew nation is arising as we speak. And I thank you, Father, that you will have your way. B'shem Yeshua. Amen. Okay. Well, anyway, Bonnie, good to have you back.
Thank you, Gene. Good to be back. Happy Thursday to you.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, I'm down here in Hammond, Louisiana, enjoying Hammond, Louisiana, which is a wonderful place to be when things are what they are in Buffalo, New York, and places like that. So,
how warm is it down there, Gene?
Down here, actually, the sun is shining, and I'd say it's probably, I mean, it's not tropical right now, but it sure is a whole lot closer to tropical. I would say maybe 65 degrees, 70 degrees.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
We had it 7 degrees the other morning here.
Oh, ouch. Those single digits. No thanks. And I don't want to ask Jim Barfield about Oklahoma either, because I know about Oklahoma and the ice storms and stuff like that. So, Jim, you there?
Yes, I am. How do you hear me?
All right.
Right.
So, what's the weather like there? Since we're discussing the weather,
it's actually pretty nice today. We've been putting up with snow and unseasonably cold weather. It's been down in the teens and twenties. Normally, we don't get this kind of weather until late December, January timeframe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. My son lived in Oklahoma City for about 2.5 years, and his standard complaint to me was the ice storms that you guys get.
Oh, they're horrible.
I mean, you guys are notorious worldwide for those things. You know, the way he used to put it was you couldn't even stand up. If you tried to stand up on the ice, you'd fall down. You know, it just was that bad. So anyway, enough of that. Now let's get around to the good stuff. Jim, you called me the other day and asked me if I couldn't get you on the program quickly, and I had made you a promise, and I'm keeping that promise. Anytime you've got something new on the Copper Scroll Project, I consider that top flight news, and I consider that absolutely important. And so I'm just going to basically let go and let you speak, because I know you've got a bunch of stuff you want to give us.
Gosh, Gene, I forgot what it was, actually. Yeah. Obviously, I'm joking. Yes, there has been. It's not new news to me, but it's going to be new news to everyone else. What has happened here recently is I've been released to tell information that I couldn't tell you the last few times I talked to you. And I've actually got some new data that has come in from a laboratory in Illinois. And before I get into that, I want to tell you the guys at 119 Ministries are awesome.
Yes.
I'm sure the majority of the audience, if not all of your audience, knows exactly who I'm talking about. They're great guys, and they did the most wonderful video for us. And they did it with no requirements, no strings attached, just because they believe in what we're doing. And in I would like, if you don't mind, there's a great guy sitting out in the audience, a member of 119, Steve Mutria. Great guy. Would it be possible to get him on as a surprise guest and let him kind of throw his two cents in here and there?
Well, you know, I mean, that's you're really asking a lot, but you know, for a few hundred dollars, I might. No, that's all right. Let me see if I can get him on. That's all right.
Well, yeah, let's get him on.
Let's get him on. I know that he's available. He said he had told me a little bit earlier. Oh, there we go. Steve. Hello, Steve.
Yes.
Can you hear us? Yes. There you are. Great. Well, you just were having your praises sung by Jim Barfield. So we decided that you had to be here to hear it. So, you're joining Bonnie Harvey, my co-host, me and Jim Barfield. There are four of us. So, anything you want to say is just nice for us to hear. So you two go right ahead.
Well, okay, one second here. I'm sorry. I need to.
Sure.
Okay, I'm here now.
But yeah, you're coming through like $1 million, right? By the way, sound great.
Oh, that's good. That's good. It was raining just a second ago here, so I'm going, oh my stars. So hey, how are you guys?
We're good, Steve. How are you down there
in Costa
Rica? Are you still in Costa Rica?
Yes, we are. I got a funny feeling I'm a little warmer than anyone else who's listening right now.
Oh, how warm are you, Steve?
I'd say we're in the mid 70s.
Life is rough.
Wow. Oh, yeah.
Lots of rain though. So anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What I would like to do, if you don't mind, is I'd like to get Steve to kind of let everybody know about the video and how we got involved in it. And guys, if you haven't seen it, you got to see it. The guy did a wonderful job. Go ahead, Steve, if you don't mind.
Sure. Okay. I'm sorry. I just came in. So you wanted me to mention, what we did with the video, you said, correct?
Yes, please.
Yeah, Steve, how did you get involved with the, with Jim's excavations over there in Israel?
Well, I would say 2.5, 2 years, something like that. Jim and myself and John and Chris Knight, we all spoke on the phone. We just introduced each other and stuff, had a good conversation. I think we talked for about 2 hours that day. And ever since then, we've just had a relationship that keeps getting stronger and stronger. And, every once in a while he'll tell me what he can tell us. You know, obviously he can't say everything all the time. And we just started really getting excited. And then this last news that this came out this year, I was like, we're going, man, we've got to get this news information out.
Yes,
and
yes.
So that's when I said, Jim, you know, let's see if we can work together on it. And then, between the both of us, we came up with this idea to just get this video out. And so we made it within like a week or so. And it was a rush job. We wanted to get out as soon as possible.
Did you go over there to Qumran to make the video, Steve?
No, all of the images that we used on that was stock footage that Jim had already had when they had done first record on excavation in 2009. Mm-hmm. And other images that he had from all the meetings and stuff he had in Israel long before all that even, and since then. And so that was all stock from those times. Mm-hmm. So, but the data was new, you know, as far as the concrete being man-made concrete they found. And then also regarding the images, the scanning images, those were all on there. And so, and right now we're, Lord willing, in the next few weeks, we're hoping to get another video started. And that will be as much info that we can give out, depending what Jim is actually able to do from the Israeli governments and what have you, as far as what we can release as far as, quote, proof to show people, hey, there's a lot here that please don't just blow this information over. There's really something people need to be considering here.
Jim, would you for the listeners, you know, they don't know maybe, would you bring them up to speed concerning your involvement with the Qumran and any other archaeologic interests that you have over there? How long have you been doing this?
It actually started 8 years ago, December the 21st, 22nd.
Okay, down to the minute here.
Was
that life-changing? What happened?
Oh my gosh, are you kidding?
Did a chandelier fall on you?
It really, I can say that with all honesty, yes, ma'am, it was life-changing. It was just so unbelievable. So it doesn't surprise me that people don't believe me when I first tell them that I've deciphered the Copper Scroll or understood the Copper Scroll. They, you know, they look at me like I'm crazy, especially people that know what it is.
Yeah.
They look at me and say, right, until, no kidding, about 5 minutes after I begin to show them my research, they start going, oh my goodness.
What happened back in September there, what, 8 years ago was that, the gym?
December. And on the Hebrew calendar, it was 1 Tevet 2006. But 2006 is not Hebrew, but 1 Tevet was whenever the discovery was made. It was at the end of Hanukkah or in the midst of Hanukkah. That's a season of, you know, the restoration of the temple. I mean, that's what they're talking about, the cleansing, restoration of the temple. And everybody knows they give out chocolate coins covered with gold and silver wrappers to look like silver and gold coins. And that's what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, isn't that appropriate?
Yeah, you what know, happened?
If, in fact, I discovered how to understand the Copper Scroll,
indeed,
we will be giving back the gold and silver of the tabernacle.
Yes.
What happened as far as how I figured it out?
May it be so, Father. May it be so. What happened there on the 1st of Tevet 2006? Tevet.
I was got up early in the morning, said my morning prayers, and I started to go to work on my chronology research, a timeline.
Timeline and of I what?
A timeline of, biblical timeline. I put it together for my own personal studies, but it's gone way viral. It's all about, you know, how to understand which prophet was where, and then it turned into prophecies. But back to the Copper Scroll.
Okay, where can people find that research that you've done?
They can write, excuse me, they can write to me on my website.
Okay, your website is?
The Copper Scroll Project. Just have them Google the Copper Scroll Project. It'll be at the top of the list, and they can get it. I'll send it to them. It's a large Excel file, so they will need at least an Excel player to be able to view it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And just a word to the listeners. It is true. Google the Copper Scroll Project, because the website has hyphens in it that if you just put in Copper Scroll Project, you're not going to find it. So do Google it, and it comes up very easily. Okay, yes.
Well,
okay,
what happened
so
that morning,
you were doing your research.
Yeah, I was going to do my research, but I decided I'd met Bendel Jones, who is a big Copper Scroll guy, about 6 months prior, and I just decided to set my chronology research aside for just a little bit and see if I could figure out the Copper Scroll. Well, within 5 minutes, and I know a lot of the guys in the audience have heard this story, and I'm going to tell them new stuff, so don't get discouraged. There's some really new stuff coming. But I figured it out just within minutes.
Now, you don't have a degree in ancient Bible languages, do you? Ancient Hebrew.
I have a DRREL. Which is, at that time that I was made the discovery, was a driver, relief driver for a fire department. So that's about it.
So this is the hand of the divine. Is that right, Jim?
Yes, ma'am. I mean it with all my heart. If my research is correct, and it appears that it is, this was by the hand of the Father. It's got nothing to do with my ability to do investigations, that sort of thing. It's by the hand of the Father.
Right. I believe that Abba likes to take, quote unquote, the least and turn them into the most, and the lowest and turn them into the highest, so to speak. Because I've seen so many people that came out of humble origins who have done such amazing things with his hands, you know.
Well, look at Yeshua. Harry is a carpenter from, you know, far-flung, you know, Hicksville, you know, astounding the Jerusalem rabbis. So that certainly is a pattern.
Yeah, of course about
it. Wonderful. So you looked at the scroll, and now explain to the audience what the copper scroll is and why it couldn't be deciphered.
The copper scroll is literally a scroll made out of about six, almost 7 feet of copper hammered flat at the time of Jeremiah. They created this metal scroll so that it would last a long time. And I absolutely believe that it was Jeremiah that was in charge of this operation right at the end of the Babylonian, or just as the Babylonian sieges were beginning. The place actually where all this, the golden treasures are at, was under attack. Jeremiah, the men of Qumran stood together. They held their ground. It was a place of priests. And in the Bible, it's called, I believe it's in Nehemiah. The Bible calls it the priests, the men of the plains. That's not what it meant. The word for plains is kikar. That word also translates into talents. Remember the story about the talents that were buried? And well, they're talking about gold and silver ingots. That really the translation is really the priests, the men of the talents, as in weights and measurements for gold. So they, even in the Bible, it mentions these people that stood and they battled against the Babylonians. They won just barely, but they defeated the Babylonians and maintained control of Qumran. And they realized then, you guys, we have got to get this stuff under the ground. We've got to get it buried. And they didn't have, you know, trucks or anything to haul it around with. So they just buried it where it stood. And they did. Apparently it worked. It's been 2,400 years approximately since that all took place, and we're still waiting to see it come out of the ground.
Well, Abba is just as good at concealing things as he is of revealing them.
and he did a great job. Yeah.
Yep. I think the time has arrived for it to be revealed, and he just happens to be using you as the tool.
And that, you know what, that's what Stephen and the 119 Ministries guys did so well, is they put in 10 minutes, they did such an excellent, they just told the story like within 10 minutes. It takes me 3 hours. They did it in 10. It's amazing. And I encourage everyone in your audience, please spread the news. I'm not asking for money. I'm asking you to spread the news and let people know what is potentially on the horizon. This, with all the events that are taking place in Israel, and I would like to touch on that today. We are on the, we very well, I shouldn't say we are, because I'm not a prophet. We are very well on our way to seeing all these things come out of the ground, because it's prophesied in every document, except for the Copper Scroll, every document that talks about these treasures. It says they will come out at the end of days, at the time of the Messiah, at the time of the regathering of the people. Well, guys, that's what all of us in this audience are about, is the looking forward to the coming of the Mashiach.
Yes.
So, yes. Steve, kind of explain to him what we're looking at doing on the next video.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, this next video, we're really hoping to get all the data that we can, release. And what will be is to show people that, look, don't just take our word for it. Here's some of the very things we can show you. And Jim has shared much of this with me already, not even all of it. And man, when you see it, your jaw just hits the floor. You go, oh my stars, how in the world, you know, and it's just, and it makes sense. Whenever he says, you know, people probably, you know, kind of, hem-haw around saying, yeah, sure, right, you found this, whatever, or you broke the code. But when you start seeing what the Copper Scroll shows, and then from the findings that they went and done some things over there already, and you see it, you really go, oh my stars, this has more validity than what I even thought, imagined at first. You know, yeah, it's really there.
Let's go back to that, Steve. You know, where was the Copper Scroll found, Jim? Was that in Qumran?
Yes, it was found at Qumran, about a quarter of a mile north of Qumran in 1952.
Correct, yeah.
By the way, real quickly, Bonnie, don't forget what you're going to say. We'd like to invite listeners to call in. I mean, I cannot believe that we've got listeners out there that don't have questions that they would like to ask Jim and Steve. So please, feel free to call in, and that's 503-967-3001. Okay, Bonnie, go ahead. Sorry.
What is it that you – what is the code that you craft in the Copper Scroll that, you know, got you excited about – what did the Copper Scroll say?
What we're going to do, like with what Steve was talking about with the video, is I'm going to disclose a small portion, enough that if you got a lick of sense, you'll be able to understand that the probability is very high. It really wasn't in code. It was in code for men.
Yes.
Men cannot follow instructions. They won't stop at a gas station. They don't need the instructions for the bicycle.
Ouch.
They know how to do it.
and it says this is the location of treasure. Is that, you know, kind of fundamentally what it says?
Yes, ma'am. It what it does, it begins off like this. Under the ruins in the Valley of Akkor. Well, there's the first piece of information. Well, I got to go to the Valley of Akkor. I knew where the Valley of Akkor was at, and probably all the people in the audience know where it's at, biblically speaking.
Is that the Dead Sea Valley?
Yes, it is. The upper northern region of the Dead Sea Valley, right there just above the Dead Sea.
Right.
Now, the next thing was it said under the ruins in the Valley of Akkor, so I looked for a set of ruins, and the only set of ruins that I was familiar with is Qumran. So I took Qumran. And I thought, well, I'll test it first. If these things don't match up with Qumran, I'll go to the next ruins in that area, which there's not very many. Excuse me. So the next clue was at the steps heading east. There's only one set of steps heading east at Qumran. I found it, and I thought, oh my goodness. Let's see what happens here. And it said that the steps were 40 cubits long. Well, I took a measurement from my buddy Joe Good. He gave me 19.2 inches is what he told me to use. I took that measurement, and I worked with the official documentation for that set of ruins, and it was exactly 40 cubits long. I thought, oh, my goodness. Well, isn't that a coincidence? Well, that's how it began. And what I did was I looked at the words on the Copper Scroll, and I thought, okay, I've got to do this methodically. So every word that meant gold, Zahab, I plugged in the word gold. Everywhere where it talked about silver, I plugged in that word. Dig, I put that word. Under, I put that word. So I filled up the whole thing with those words, and then I went back and found the other words that were unusual, like peristyle. That is an open courtyard. Once I plugged all the words in for a specific sentence, then I would read it, and I would follow the instructions. And lo and behold, it just worked like a dream. It worked incredibly well.
Wow. By the way, I want to mention to everybody – the video that we're talking about that's already been made, you need to go look at it if you haven't already. Just go to copperscrollproject.com and play the video.
There are hyphens in there, Gene. They need to Google it. There are hyphens in there.
You can also go to testeverything.net, and it's on our front page.
Ah, great. Okay. So I advise that anyone who hasn't already gone to see it, go look at it. It's like, as Jim said, it's only about 10 minutes. And it will really do a great job of bringing you up to speed on what's happening at light speed in that ministry right now.
Okay.
Oh, no, there we go. We're going into break. Hold that comment, Jim. Everybody stick with us. We've got an hour and a half more with you. You carry me through the darkest night.
shadow of death into the light.
PJC Salem.
Alrighty, here we are back to the Thursday Morning Show with Jim Barfield and Steve Matria. We are discussing the parameters of the Third Temple here and the discovery, the Copper Scroll at the Qumran Project. Jim, I would like to go, to keep this in sequence to, what is the new finding there? And then we go to Steve and he can kind of, balance, he can kind of put in perspective what many people already, feel that they know.
Sure. Yeah. That's not a problem.
Okay.
Steve's worked with me on this video. And we put quite a bit of information in 10 minutes. Really well done. And what we've discovered, we sent some cement that was found at the cave entrance, where I believe the cave entrance is. I shouldn't say so positively. But we found some cement there. And it says in the book of Second Maccabees that Jeremiah sealed the cave. And he made it where it couldn't be recognized as a cave. It is my strong opinion, but it has been since I started this project, that they sealed it with a masonry wall. Well, if you have a masonry wall, then you have to have a mortar to seal the stones together, to bond the stones together. And we thought to ourselves, why in the world is there concrete here? Why is there cement looking substance? So we sent it to a lab in Illinois. And the last word I got was, the day that we released the video. I mean, just moments before we were releasing the video, I got confirmation, about the concrete or the cement, the mortar. And the gentleman told me he was a doctor, and that was his field of study. He said, "Mr. Barfield, I can say with no reservation that this is a man-made substance," which just, that is incredibly important to from a research perspective. And so we can put that on our research and in our research to help prove that this location has high probabilities.
That here you have a man-made sealed opening. Have you done any sound studies, ultrasound studies of that opening, or metallurgic studies of that? What was behind that cement?
Yes, we have. But before we get to that, do you mind if we get Steve on here, because that's very important, and do not let me forget to talk about that. But I'd like to get Steve on here again for a second.
Okay.
Steve? I think one thing that has, when we first announced everything on our Facebook page, we were getting lots of people saying, wait a minute, Jim Barfield already, not Jim Barfield, it was Ron Wyatt had already found this and all this other stuff. And please know that we are huge Ron Wyatt fans. We think he's, done lots of good stuff. And now there's lots of, debate. Did he find this? Did he find that? The thing is, he really, woke the archaeological world up to biblical finds and different things.
And this is concerning Ron Wyatt. This is concerning the temple treasures, the table of showbread, the candlestick, the Ark of the Covenant. Is that correct?
Well, Ron Wyatt, to our understanding, never claimed to find all of those items. But his biggest find, to our understanding, was the Ark of the Covenant. But in everything that he had given forth, there was nothing for us to study, nothing for us to test and say, wow, this is true. Mm-hmm. And I did some teachings not long ago. One of them was the changing of the priesthood. And it was in that really started challenging myself to Ron's finding, because I know Ron Fine is saying that the Ark of the Covenant was under the Golgotha where Yeshua was crucified. Mm-hmm. And his theory was simply that his blood, since he became the new high priest, his blood had to be on the atonement cover. Mm-hmm. The thing is, though, Yeshua could not be a priest on earth, according to Hebrews chapter 8. Matter of fact, verse 4, it says, if he were on earth, he would not be a priest, for there are already men who offer their gifts prescribed by the law. Meaning what? Yeshua could not do any kind of earthly priestly duty, or he would be breaking the law. So that in itself poses a problem to his theory. And then another one is, the only time that the Ark of the Covenant can have blood placed on it is on the Day of Atonement. This was not the Day of Atonement. So again, that would be two elements where Yeshua would be breaking the law. But that would be holding to Ron's theory. So it kind of puts some concern for us in that. But with everything that, you know, Jim has been finding, it's all there. Matter of fact, if I can add one more element to it, according to 2 Maccabees, it shows that even the tent of meeting is with the Ark of the Covenant. A lot of times, and I know that we might receive a lot of flack from this, but a lot of people are looking for another temple to be made. Now, we're not saying one won't be made, but here's our problem with it. They use the verse in 2 Thessalonians, thinking it's verse 4, and it says something like, he will oppose and exalt himself over everything that is God, or called God, I think it says, or worshipped. And then it says that he will set himself up in God's temple, claiming to be God. The word there used for temple is not the same word used that we find when Yeshua says he's going to go to the temple or these things. It's a totally different word. The word that Paul uses here is actually a word for use for shrine or a temporary tabernacle. And it's the same word that Paul uses saying, do you not know that we are God's temple? Meaning we are the temple, the tabernacle today. And also to add more to this, it's the same word that is used in Revelation that describes the temple in heaven. And it says, and God's temple was open in heaven. And then simple people say, well, what's the big deal about it? Well, here's the thing. Hebrews tells us that the tabernacle that Moses was informed to make was actually modeled after that which he saw in heaven. So therefore, God's tabernacle in heaven, a temple in heaven, is actually a tabernacle. So and what we're saying is this. It's very plausible that the Antichrist himself will set himself up in God's original tabernacle. Not a temple, but the original tabernacle. And so with this find, knowing that this tabernacle, according to 2 Maccabees, is right there with the Ark of the Covenant, wow, it just plays into perfect harmony, and it just really makes sense. And we just recorded a new teaching on this regarding the Tent of Meeting. It's a short 5-minute teaching on it. We're going to start making end-time videos more shorter, and this is our first one. But it really opens things up and realizing that this all the more plays to a possibility of end time prophetic reality.
What is the word used, in Revelation when it says the Antichrist or the pseudo Messiah will set up a likeness of himself in a wing of the temple? I mean, it sounds like, you know, that's a pretty, I mean, to have a wing on it.
That's a misunderstanding. I don't have the verse in front of me though. Okay. I remember studying this. Uh-huh. That's actually the temple word is not there. It's actually a wing of the city, and that's actually believed to be East Jerusalem today because Jerusalem has grown. So it's actually going to be in the original Jerusalem.
I see. Okay. Jim. Now. You're wondering from the copper scroll if the temple treasures, and plus, the tabernacle, from the desert, all of that could be behind this man-made cement. You know, how does the 40 stairs going east, how does that figure into this?
The only thing that does, any of the instructions that you find on the copper scroll, other than those that actually indicate temple treasures, for example, it even names the ephod being inside of that cave, which is the ephod is the breastplate of righteousness. So you see what's happened here is those instructions about the 40 cubit steps, that mm-hmm. is that's simply a checkpoint. Go here, look here, find this.
I see.
That's all it is. Now, okay. Now, what's important is another thing that you brought up about the Animasiah.
Yeah.
The Animasiah, the people are saying, oh, my goodness. Well, not many. One or two have said, but it's an important subject to bring up. Oh, my goodness, these things are going to be used by the Animasiah. Well, you know what? That's a possibility.
It's still prophecy.
Yep, there you go. It's prophecy. It's not that we're doing something evil or wrong. It's what the Antimessiah does is evil and wrong. If that's the case, God should have never made these implements. They're going to be used by the Antimessiah in the end days. And I don't know that he will ever even touch them, to be honest with you. However, that's an important subject, and it's something we need to touch on. The next thing is this. The cave, you had mentioned earlier about testing we've done. Guys, listen to this. I did test Qumran. I used a very powerful metal detector with a digital readout that actually showed me a map of the area that we scanned. And oh my goodness, there is the amounts that are there are just mind boggling.
The amounts of what?
Gold and silver.
And that shows up on a metallurgic report?
Yes, ma'am, it does. And I've got the reports. I scanned, we compared it, and the markings indicated the same locations where I suspected that there would be non-ferrous metals. Now, that could mean brass, silver, gold, copper. You know, take your choice. However,
I see. Just something non-ferrous.
Yes, non-ferrous. Now, ferrous metals are iron, steel, that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, what happened was this. We scanned four locations, and of those four locations, all of them indicated non-ferrous metals and in large amounts. I took about 25 pounds of silver, put it out in my front yard, used the same device that I used in Israel, and the only indication I got was a tiny little blue blip for 25 pounds. Well, the indications that I got in this area were enormous. It showed massive quantities. And I'm thinking, oh, my goodness, this is confirming. Now, is there a possibility that there was an anomaly? Absolutely. Is there a possibility that something went wrong? And it's possible. But I'm saying the probability is like 80 to 90% that everything that this device indicated is there. I mean, especially at the cave.
Is it possible to get a sonar scan of this cave? Is that possible?
No, I'm going to say no, because the sonar scans and the underground radar, they don't work very well in this area for whatever reason. And this is at the word of the archaeologist that was with me whenever we did this, the 2009 excavation. However, the metal detector, that is a specific, and it's specifically looking for a target from metal. So that's a very good thing.
Now, you know, if there's non-ferrous, a considerable amount of non-ferrous metals there, you would think the Israeli government, you know, would issue a permit for excavation yesterday. You know, what is going on there, Jim?
Well, let's go there. Let's go with the events that are happening in Israel, because that's where we're at. That's the problem. They don't want these things found. The secular government, the secular people in Israel do not want these things found. A rabbi contacted me. His name is Rabbi Yehuda Gleck. He's the gentleman that was shot.
Yeah.
Yes.
Not too long ago. He contacted me as I was going to the airfield to come back from the scan. He had found out about me doing the scan, and he said, Mr. Barfield, he wanted to work with me, he wanted to talk to me, and I'm gonna make him the offer of allowing him to use my equipment for his research. He's a great guy, and the situation over there, for him to be shot was just terrifying to me. I mean, for him, I'm not too concerned about it, but it's the situation in Israel is getting worse by the minute. And let me tell you another thing. The gentleman, Moshe Feiglin, who is a deputy speaker of the Knesset, Israel's parliament, he is behind us 100%. He is very supportive of what we're doing. He's seen my research. He did the same thing. When I began showing it to him, he was kind of hem-hawing around. And I reached over in front of him when I was showing him my research. It's like he wasn't paying attention. Mm-hmm. And I think he was jet lagging. I don't know. He just got to New York City. I reached over and I slapped the table in front of us. Hey, pay attention. This is important.
Yeah.
And it kind of shocked him, but he did. He started listening and he got it, guys. He got it.
Yeah, it would seem that all you'd have to do is show him that metallurgic report in an archaeologically sensitive area, and they would want to, you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe it's not Yehovah's timing, but that would certainly, you know, pique my interest. You know, if not temple treasures, then what? I mean, this is a lot of stuff. Would it upset anything else in the Qumran area if you know were permitted to pierce that concrete wall?
No, ma'am. It's about 300 yards away from anything sensitive like that. So that could be easily done. However, I'm telling you, the guys that are in charge of the so-called West Bank, it's really Judea Samaria. Mm-hmm. They don't want these things found. The archaeologist that was working with me that was trying to get the permits for the scanning said, Jimmy, they don't want you to do anything because of what you might find. They really, right. He said, they think you're going to find something. That's why they're so scared of this.
But we've had guests on here before. I mean, the population now, you know, is going from 90% against the temple, you know, even 8 years ago to, you know, actually flip-flopping 90% in favor of the temple. So it must be the leadership that is not in favor of the temple, because certainly the population, you know, from all reports seems to be in favor of the third temple.
Well, let me tell you this. You're right. It is the secular leadership of Israel that is against this. And I encourage people, listen closely out there in the audience. Type in, do a search either on YouTube, or I'll give you the site name for MK Moshe Feiglin analyzes the Israeli Arab conflict. Search for that, and let me pull up the. It's a short. It's called blog.mflikud.com, which stands for Moshe Feiglin Likud.com. So it's blog.mflikud.com, and watch the video. He had an interview with a secular radio or TV host, and you got to listen to his answers and listen to them closely. The guy is sharp as a tack. And he is pro-Israel to the bone. He is pro one state solution, a state of Israel. He is pro temple. He is very religious man. He wants these things that you and I want. He mm-hmm. wants it as well. And he is the only one in Israel that is speaking, in this direction. He's got logical answers to the problems of the, Palestinian situation. He's got logical answers for many of these things. However, you said it exactly. The leadership, the secular leadership in Israel does not want to disrupt the status quo.
They're afraid that if they find temple treasures, that it will inflame the Jewish population so that the Temple Mount issue, rebuilding of the temple issue, would overflow into you know, a race war, a religious war, or what? Is that what
they're afraid of exactly what you said, only they're afraid that it's going to overflow into the reality of a temple being built. That's what they're scared of.
They don't want the temple built. Oh,
yeah, and
okay.
they don't want to disrupt the status quo. I'm telling you, they've got their businesses, they've got their TV programs, they're happy, fat and happy. However, the history book of Israel says it's going to happen.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, it's going to happen whether they like it or not. And if you want real peace, then let them build the temple. Let us get on with this. Let the time of the Messiah come, and we will have global peace. Let's don't just settle for peace in Israel. Let's settle for global peace around the world, and that's going to happen whether they like it or not. It's coming.
The thing that we must remember is that really only happens at the coming of Yeshua. And so thus we understand how even them fighting this is really an element of prophecy, you know. And so this is why Jim and I were talking not long ago. I was telling him, I said, man, Jim, I said, I really struggle with this, even them agreeing to dig this up. And he goes, no, I agree. And I gave him a verse because I personally believe it's going to be the Father himself who reveals this. I think he's given these clues to Jim just for the location, so people will know when it's found. But in Psalm 86, Psalm 85, it says, truth springeth out of the earth, and righteousness had looked down from heaven. And it's so funny because I really feel in my heart that this could even be a hidden prophecy, meaning that truth literally springs out of the earth. The Father will reveal all this stuff in his timing. But it's at the same token, it's like the timing is so close, he wants now the people to know where it's at. So when it does spring forth, there's no questions as to what it is, where it came from, why it was put there, and now it's going to be utilized in the end days.
And you know what? He's brought up an incredibly interesting probability or possibility. Let me say that. Because we were talking about this not too long ago, and he said, what if an earthquake or something like that happened and it caused that cave to open? Well, he didn't know how close to exactly what I believe could happen.
Mm-hmm.
Because Qumran has got a split on the eastern side of Qumran. There is you can see the split in the earth, which is still about 2 feet wide, where it's not very deep because it's filled in with dust, but it's still visible where an enormous earthquake took place at that site, split one of their mikvahs right down the center. And I was telling Steve the possibility that an earthquake could happen and split near the opening and all the dirt fall away, and there would be the masonry wall still intact, still standing there.
Mm-hmm.
That could happen. And that would be awesome. And that would that would fulfill that biblical, if it's a prophecy, and it probably is, it could fulfill it. And there would be no permits needed. There would be nothing needed other than then they would call and say, hey, fireman guy, bring your maps and come on over here. We have a situation. We need you here.
Yep,
so I think
that's
Steve's
true.
Right.
Yep. You know, by the way, just really quickly, I want to parenthetically say something here. And that is, hey, all you in the Messianic/Hebrew Roots ministry out there, take a look at two ministries working together here and learn from it. Thank you guys for doing this. This is a blessing to the body, and I know that it's going to be a blessing to you as well.
It's been an absolute pleasure. It always is. And Steve and I were hoping to get this out as soon as possible. I'm going to call it the disclosure, because that's what it is, a disclosure of a small portion of the research.
Right. And I know you've been sitting on it for so long. I mean. I don't know of anybody that's been squirming over the last 2 years as much as you have.
Oh gosh. Oh gosh.
You know.
It's so, not like a standard, it's not like a standard ministry where you go out there and you tell everybody you know all the, no, I gotta keep quiet. I gotta keep
that's
my
right.
mouth.
That's right. You get to be the world's expert on how to tape your mouth shut.
Oh gosh.
Yeah, I understand. And Steve, I can't even thank you guys enough. You guys, over the course of the years that you've been in Costa Rica, I mean, that was a professionally done job. I have not seen a video anywhere any better than that, anywhere at any time. It's really a great video.
Yeah,
well,
and
thank
anything-
you. Our editor has done an awesome job. He was really tickled pink to be able to work on it. And Jim and I wrote the script, and then all during that time, our editor was just working like crazy to get some stuff on it. And Josh did a fabulous job, and he really enjoyed making it.
Wonderful. Anything else? We only have a few minutes. Anything you want to squeeze in here, either?
Yeah, actually there is.
Okay.
Pray for the peace of Jerusalem.
Absolutely. Every day.
That is absolutely crucial at this time.
Yes.
And we have to stand together with our brothers, Judah, guys.
Yep, I agree. Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We
really appreciate you guys being on with us. And Jim, anytime you let me know, we'll have you on again.
My pleasure.
Great. hang on, everybody. We've got the Anadai coming next.
Welcome to the Hebrew Nation Morning Show, where we discuss the biblical roots of our people and our faith. Link to Accurate Precious Metals Refineries, our morning show sponsor at HebrewNationOnline.com. Lines are open, so call 503-967-3001 if you would like to join in the conversation. You can also chat with us online in the morning show chat room at HebrewNation.net.
All right, we're back for the second hour, and this show is one of those shows that if you blink, you're going to miss it because there's just way too much going on. This hour, we're going to have Deanna Dai as our guest, and she is in the process of developing a whole new thought process, a whole new thread of investigation regarding Revelation and how it relates to the temple. Did I get that right, Deanna?
Yes, you did, Gene. Good morning.
Great. Great. And by the way, Bonnie is here with us as well.
Hi, Bonnie,
you there, right? Yep. Hi.
Good morning, Deanna.
go right ahead, Deanna. I'm all ears.
Okay. Well, I thought I would just kind of explain how I got here. Just kind of a quick overview. I became a believer in Messiah in 1979. And at that time, the only thing that was going on really was Jews for Jesus. So that was kind of my formative years, although we did have the formulations of the Messianic movement. And so when I came in, there really wasn't anywhere for me to go as a Jew, if you will, you know. So my husband and I ended up in the church. We served in the Assemblies of God for quite a few years. So basically.
Wow. AG.
Yeah. You toe the party line when you're in that environment. And I would try to introduce things. Of course, it never went over all that well. Eventually, my husband and I left the church. But in those, I would say around the early 90s, I connected with Joe Good, and him and I were good friends. So those early years, I, you know, studied under him in terms of the temple and went through that sort of process and then kind of went out on my own. But around, I would say, maybe 98, 99, somewhere in there, I actually stopped studying prophecy. Because what I figured out is pretty much everything I taught was wrong. And really, I couldn't make sense of it. And so for really, I don't know, 8 years now, I haven't even gone near it. And so I decided I needed to go back to the very beginning and really understand the basics. And so I ended up back, always doing research on the temple. But really just about 3 years ago, I finally was able to put the pattern together so it made sense. And I recorded probably six different topics related to the temple, but I began to see the big picture. And really, that's what I'm trying to do here. I mean, I'm a detail freak. I look for the smallest, insignificant details in scripture to try to pull something out. But I think it's time for us to kind of step back and see, really to see the whole picture. So even though in about, I don't know, 92, 93, 94, I did quite a bit of study on the ancient Near East, and I filed it away. And so now I went back and started to look at that with new eyes. So I kind of view this as sort of cold case. For instance, you know, sometimes you got to put it away and just not look at it so that you can go back with fresh eyes. And then you start seeing things and having laid a much more solid foundation in terms of the temples. Now, Joe is certainly the expert on the mechanics and structure, you know, of the temple. So I didn't want to reinvent the wheel. I mean, the guy's already got it all figured out. So I sort of went off in a little bit of a different direction to try to make an application. So my basic premise was that if God lived in this world, in this physical world in which we lived in, if he had a body, he would look like what the temple looks like, the structure of the temple that we have on Mount Moriah. So I kind of took off with that. So we know, we understand that he is male and female. And so the context here of the temple as a house, the, how we can make an application, of course, is that a house is male and female. They come together, conceive, produce fruit. And that basically is the sons that would come forth. Now, in Hebrew thinking, sons were more important than daughters. That was how a house grew. And offense to the daughters, but that's just how they thought anciently. So the pattern of male and female, a house, the context of the house, the place where fruit is produced, the place where the seed is preserved and protected, this thinking just keeps repeating itself over and over. So every father of every house is a picture of God the Father, the rock, and every female of every, or mother of every house is a picture of the Holy Spirit. So the, you know, the rock and the spirit, if you will. And I can go into the whole thing about the rock and the Holy of Holies and the water coming out, which we don't probably even have time to go there. But this is the imagery and the picture and the pattern that I started to see. Now, of course, God does not dwell in this world. But he sent, well, first we have Adam, and of course Adam was created male and female. And then Hava was separated out from him. And every time there's a separation or division in scripture, it's for a purpose and a function. So she was separated out from Adam for a purpose and a function so that the two could come back together and be one and produce fruit. Because really that's the bottom line for everything. So when Yeshua comes, he's a picture of the second Adam, and it's the same concept. So in the beginning, God, and I look at Genesis 1:3, the Spirit of God hovered over the waters, and the Spirit being the feminine essence, and God being the male essence, if you will, coming together, hovering, being act of conception over the waters, the womb. And so life comes forth at that point, same pattern. He is conceived by this, the seed of God, and the Spirit joins the seed, and now the womb here, in this case, is Miriam. She's kind of the holding tank for the fruit to come forth. So that's the pattern that I've been working with for probably 2 or 3 years. So I wanted to go back and look at the ancient Near East understanding, because what's happened to us is not only are we victims of Western culture, civilization, thinking, but we're also victims of modernism, the age, from the age of enlightenment and reason to now, we look at everything scientifically with modern eyes. And it's very hard for us to see things the way the ancient cultures did. Now, I'm not going to live back in the time of the ancient cultures, but honestly, if we're going to understand a lot of the scriptures, we're going to have to go back there and see, you know, what was their thinking. So going back to the very beginning, Genesis chapter 1, we find that really in ancient thinking, the temple and the cosmos were the same thing. So everything, if you will, outside of time was a temple. And of course, God made, we have a temple, physical temple inside of time, which is an actual physical building. But without that understanding, I think it's hard for us to go forth. So we have the pattern of the 7 days, and I'm not going to get into all that. But what, I read an excellent book recently that kind of explained things in terms of the 7 days represented a temple dedication. So as we go through, we're dedicating a temple, if you will, starting in the beginning. And in fact, you know, one of the names for the Jerusalem temple was heaven and earth. So in the beginning, God created as a function heaven and earth. So we have this structure of the temple right out of the gate. And so we go through this pattern of inauguration. So all the sevens in scripture relate to temple inauguration. And that's key, especially when we look at the book of Revelation. Because it is filled with sevens everywhere. Would you not agree?
Yes, that's true.
And so when it says that he rested, it's not that God was, you know, sitting up there, you know, legs folded, reading a book, playing a harp, and all was done, and that's it, over. It means that sort of a crisis, if you will, has been resolved, and now stability and order has been achieved. So on that day, the seventh, if you will, the natural functioning and operation of the temple begins from that place. And so that we find this thinking over and over and over again. And the ancient Near East people, as you read through some of the literature and just some of the various books that have been written about that period of time, everything was about sevens. It just has blown my mind. So they basically believed that there were seven spheres, if you will. So when you if you're going on a horizontal, you got heaven, earth, and underneath the earth. And then if you go on a vertical, you've got north, south, east, and west. So those were sort of the seven spheres. And then if you fill in with that grid, you end up with sort of 12 regions. And so that, again, that all relates back to really the book of Revelation. So my premise then is that the structure of the book of Revelation has everything to do with the temple. And what we see here is basically two systems in conflict. So the worship of two systems. So for obviously we have the one true God, and then he lives outside of time, but he has put his image into his house, and that is the living God, that would be Messiah, in contrast to the kingdom, if you will, of Hasatan, who continues to put his image inside his house.
And Diana, just for a moment, we got a caller call in. So, caller hung up. They just hung up. I'm sorry. I don't know why they hung up, but go right ahead. I'm sorry. I apologize for interrupting you.
That's okay. So you see these two sort of worship systems in conflict. These temple structures are in conflict in the book of Revelation. That really is, I believe, the whole structure of the book. And so now we find over the course of human history that Hasatan wants to put his image, or his idol, if you will, into God's temple. So that's what he keeps trying to do over and over and over again. And we describe that as the abomination that causes desolation. So the living God has his living image in his living house. Again, picture of Adam and Messiah. And then Hasatan has his, because in the ancient Near East cultures, the God lived upstairs, if you will, and they put their own image inside the temple, their temple that they had constructed. And let me just mention, I always thought that the ziggurat was the temple, and then I come to find out differently that the ziggurat actually was the altar. So there was a temple, a ziggurat, and a garden.
The ziggurat was inside the temple?
It was beside it.
Oh, okay, okay.
So now you have, you know, and they were shaped like a stair step. And so the idea, if you could see the pattern of the altar in the same way, so as one approached or went up, made aliyah to the altar and would burn an offering on there, in order to, one was ascending, in order to ascend up to God, and God would come down to meet them. That was sort of the imagery that we have. So the ziggurat was essentially the same function, was for basically for the God to come down from heaven, and then he had stairs so he could come on down.
Right.
And so then in the temple itself, the image of that God would be in the temple. And that image, you know, obviously wood, clay, or, you know, stone, but not living. And so, and let me just mention here, if you study ancient Near East culture, most of the scholars will tell you that it is Israel that is taken from the ancient Near East cultures and created their own cult, you know, their cultic practices. When to me, it's the other way around, that the ancient cultures took from what God established in the beginning. But scholars never go there. And so that's the pattern. Always, there was always a garden in these early temples. And so it shouldn't come as much of a surprise that's kind of been stolen, if you will, from what God established in the beginning. So the whole purpose of people, they would, as they approached their temples in that context, was to take care of the image that was inside the temple, you know, on behalf of their God. And so they would have to feed it and clothe it and take care of it and wash it and, you know, and do all that sort of thing.
Demonstrating their commitment to and their love for and their reverence for the deity itself. Yeah. Okay.
And the other thing I'd like to mention too is that, and what's difficult for us as well, because we compartmentalize our lives, but anciently everything was a temple for them. That was their, you know, 24/7, 365 days a year. They didn't put little boxes, okay, you know, today I go to work, but Friday, hallelujah, here's Shabbat. You know, everything was the construct of the temple. And in fact, I guess I'll just let myself go off on this direction. But it anciently, and really what we see in the context of the temple that God built, is that the highest form of worship in that temple was eating. So everything right. became about eating. So when they had a garden, the purpose of the garden was to grow food, so you had food to eat. And then, of course, then you can feed the image of the god. So the same pattern we see for Adam. You know, yes, he was in the garden, and we see that he guarded and he served in the garden, but we don't understand it as connected to temple thinking. And again, let me just remind people that they saw the entire cosmos as a temple. It wasn't sort of some little thing over here that you did, you know, Monday at 3. It was their whole world. So Adam is in the garden, and it tells us he was serving. And the Hebrew word there is avodah, which is a word very much connected to the service in the temple. So he was growing food, and it was great. I mean, he's pruning and watering and planting seed and, you know, doing all that you got to do to grow food. And it was easy.
Right.
The purpose of the temple was for food. And that's why we have all this stuff with Paul talking about, you know, offering food to idols.
Right.
So that's kind of the distinction between the two. And again, as I mentioned earlier, that the enemy always wants to set up his image inside the temple. But we have, you know, basically with God's economy is living, breathing life. And then the other Hasatan's economy is death. And so these things are always in conflict, and it doesn't, you take a rocket scientist, look outside our window and see that that's the battle constantly between the living and the dead. So I don't know if you want to insert anything in here.
Go ahead. Well, the one thing that sort of struck me in the comments that you made was, you know, you talk about Adam tending to and seeding and tilling and doing all the things connected with raising food. And of course, this was before he was condemned to have to create that food by the sweat of his brow. So like right. you say, it had to be very, very easy to raise those crops at that point in time.
Wouldn't we just love that today?
Yeah, exactly. And I think you're right. I think it was probably so different that we don't even have a conception of it. We're so used to the sweat of the brow thing.
Yeah. And it sort of reiterates what Paul says. If you don't work, you don't eat. And right. that's really a temple concept going back. And so now when, we had a worship conference last week, but I was trying to explain to people again, because we compartmentalize our lives between what we do and then our time that we set aside on the Shabbat for God. But really what you do, your function is the key to everything, because the structure of Genesis is a functionary thing. The temple on earth, if you will, was created for a function, and of course in the image of the temple as the cosmos. But one must find one's work and do it with one's whole heart. That is your work. That is the most basic definition of work, to work to eat. And so here we are now in a culture that is so far removed from how food even grows. These kids think that everything comes out of a supermarket. Do you not think that was by design? Surely the enemy, you know, that's what a great tool, so that people don't even see or relate that their work and their work and worship are one and the same. And
yeah, I'd really like a steak, but don't kill that cow.
Yeah, exactly.
You're right.
So I'm hoping at least out of this that people will start to understand the importance of their work that they do. And that if you're not doing the work that God's called you to do, then don't waste any more time and find out what it is and do it with your whole heart. Because you know when you're doing the work he's called you and you're functioning in that way, I mean, it doesn't matter what happens around you. You know that you're center of his will. And think about how many people are doing things they hate, and it's a drudgery, and it's all they can do to get up in the morning. But they're working because they have to eat. So nothing's changed here.
Yeah, it's just that if they have a job that matches up with the things that they love to do, it can actually be a pleasure and a joy instead of an arduous thing, instead of a hurtful thing, and instead of the burden that we all do so much to try to avoid. You know, I saw a movie recently, and it started with a quote. I can't remember. It's the new Denzel Washington movie, whatever that's, The Fugitive, or no, I forget what it was called. But anyway, there's a quote at the beginning of the movie that says, the two most important days of your life are the day you were born and the day you find out why you were born.
Amen.
That's and true. Boy, what a great way to put it. And I agree with you. That's Abba's intention for us. Yeah. I think there's no more important thing that we can seek out than the purpose for which we were placed here.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, there are people that pass on that never, ever find that out. And yes, it's the true joy of your life.
Right.
Is when you connect to that and you understand the will of God for your life and you do it with your whole heart and with all the passion that, you know, that you can muster up, if you will. And
amen.
So, yeah, that's worship in a nutshell, if you will.
Right.
So, one of the things too, I guess we'll kind of talk about some of the interesting comparisons then between, the structure of the temple that we understand, and what the ancient Near East folks thought. So as I'm starting to work through the book of Revelation, and I'm just sort of setting the stage here, this is the pattern of how I'm looking at it.
Right.
It occurred to me that the chapter one is really dealing with the picture of the whole house as it's manifested in a description of Yeshua as a priest. So that chapter one kind of looks at it that way. One of the things that I've always puzzled over is chapters 2 and 3, of course, are talking about the seven congregations. Of course, there's our number 7, again, in relationship to temple and dedication, you know, a temple dedication. But why did he pick those 7? Because there are myriads of congregations. Why just the 7 in Asia Minor? Have you ever thought about that?
That's true. You're right. They were singled out for some reason.
So my opinion, but those particular cities were sort of the high points of the counterfeit worship. You know, so we have the emperor worship. Those cities were the true, best examples of the kingdom of the beast, if you will, and worshiping in that. So, you know, we have the Ephesus, the temple of Diana, no relation, or Artemis.
Yes.
So, you know, I think that's really one of the reasons those 7 in particular were chosen. Mm-hmm. And then when we get into chapters 4 and 5, now we see the full expression of the temple as the cosmos in those two chapters. Just amazing descriptions when you think about it. So from there, you know, we go into the rest of the book, and then we see this sort of this conflict that's taking place between the worship of the one true God and the worship of the beast. And I just think this is a thing that goes back to, you know, really to the very first Genesis 1. And unfortunately, or whatever, we keep trying to take all these little pieces of information and make them become something that maybe they're not meant to become. And that's what I mean about just sort of stepping back and seeing the big picture. Now, I don't declare to be some prophecy expert by any stretch of the imagination. But I'm starting to just wonder about us plugging, you know, sort of modern states, if you will, into the concept of all these 7s. Again, because that is ancient mythology is built around the concept of the number 7. So, mm-hmm. But I'll let other people figure that one out. So for instance, one of the most important elements in the ancient Near East culture, not only the temple as sort of the cosmos, but the temple as the cosmic mountain, if you will. So now we know all through scripture, we got mountains and everywhere. So here's how they saw it. There's sort of the water that covers the earth. And as like the womb, and as the creative process comes forth, sort of dry ground or some sort of hill emerges out of the earth. And this hill, they call it the primordial hill, eventually gets bigger and bigger and bigger and becomes the mountain. So now they equate the temple with the mountain. So the whole of the mountain becomes a temple. And this is the this is the first place in which life, dry ground, if you will, emerged out of the waters. Now in Hebrew thinking, it's not so much a hill. Well, it is a mountain, but it's specifically a rock. So you know that they talk about the foundation stone. In Hebrew, that's the Evan Shetia. And it means the water, the stone of drinking. So out of the waters comes this stone, the stone of drinking. Now that is said to be the bedrock on top of Mount Moriah. And it.
Deanna, hang on. We've got a break going on here. Everybody stick with us. We have another half hour regarding the temple.
Hebrew-lessons.com.
KPJC Salem.
Alrighty, we are back for the last half hour here, and we have Deanna Dye with us, Dr. Deanna Dye, and we are, let me see, we were right to the bedrock, I believe, of the of the Temple Mount.
Amen. Yeah. So I talked a little bit about how out of the waters, and we mentioned that it was coming, like coming out of the womb, if you will. This is the pattern that we repeat over and over again. So you understand in the Revelation, excuse me, in Genesis story, on the third day when the waters were separated from the earth. And remember, everything is about a function. We tend to look at everything in material and substantive terms, but the whole creation week is about a function. And again, I mentioned earlier, when you divide or separate something, it's for a function. So now we divide and separate the seas from the earth in order for dry ground to appear. And this pattern of dry ground speaks of life coming forth. And so when we see it in the story of Noah, we see it when the children of Israel cross over the Yam Suf, they cross over on dry ground because that's when life comes forth out of the earth. And so, of course, we have Adam who will come forth out of the earth, out of the dust of the earth, which is actually said to be at the spot of the altar. And new life or sprout, the word there that's used about for the sprouting coming forth is the Hebrew word deshe, which is only found a few times in scripture, and in particular Psalm 23, talking about green pastures. So green pastures actually turns out to be an idiom for the temple where new life comes forth. Again, I mentioned at the top of the last hour, it's about male, female coming together, conceiving and producing life. So now we have this life that comes forth out of the earth, which is again a picture of the resurrection of the dead, and we see that in the life of Yeshua. So this constant theme is really repeated. And so then not only see that the temple has multiple idioms, multiple meanings, multiple metaphors, because it encompasses everything. I go back to the whole of the cosmos is a temple. So there's all these different, it's like a diamond with these different facets, but it's all still the temple. So you know that in the story when David purchased the ground, you remember he purchased it from Arnon as a threshing floor. So what we end up having, the threshing floor actually represents the altar, and then the granary, the barn, the storehouse is the temple itself, because that's the place where the seed is stored. Going back to the male and female principle, the seed is incubated inside the house, which is the womb. And another more imagery of the temple is as the womb, and then new life comes forth. So we just, all these things, all these facets. And, this concept of green pastures ends up being related then, you know, to the garden and the growing of food. I mean, it's just endless. We could talk about that.
That's interesting, that it is important that the use of the, Temple Mount previously was, a threshing floor.
Yeah. I know. Wow. I mean,
to winnow, you know, the chaff from the wheat.
Right. And to store the grain. The grain seed had to be protected for use to replant and to store for future. And that kind of brings to light the whole story of Joseph, right? What was he doing? Because Goshen was actually a picture of the temple.
Oh, and wow, really?
Yes, because think of it, that's the place where the seed was preserved. And remember, they ate quite well there. And that was the place, a supernatural place of the presence of God on earth. Everything outside, you know, which is a picture of exile. The Egyptians are subject to all this stuff. One of the interesting things about the temple, it's also called a labyrinth or a cave. Now, we think that Joseph and the granary was that labyrinth that we have in ancient Egypt, a possibility. So all of it ties together. So I'll just kind of throw this out too. If we take the word Goshen and we add a hay on the end, which will, becomes Goshenah, which means towards Goshen. If you take those letters, they're the same letters that are on a dreidel. Nes Gadol HaYasham, a great miracle happened there. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. So lots of pictures and patterns there. So Goshen ends up being a picture of the womb, because the temple is a picture of the womb. And so when the Israelites are leaving, what happens? The sea parts, just like a birth canal, and they are birthed out of Egypt, out of exile, into the wilderness.
I have never thought of it that way. That's amazing. Wow.
That's what I'm saying. If we could just start seeing it as a pattern for the family, it will absolutely change your understanding. Because it's,
well, you know,
go ahead.
I was going to say, one of the things that Joe really has managed to hammer into my head is the idea that if you're not watching for the tabnit, if you're not watching for the patterns and the blueprints, you are not going to see the truths that are there, period.
That's exactly right. Now, I don't know. I think maybe God gave me a gift to see the patterns.
Yes.
I'm like a pattern freak. I tell people it's probably because I watched Perry Mason too much.
well, you're far more productive than Perry Mason. So go ahead.
Thank you. But, you know, it's that idea of looking for clues to see how things connect. And like I said, the whole point of all this was to just, let's just back up, because I was getting caught too much in the minutiae and the little details, which I still go there. But can we just back up and see this whole picture? So from beginning to end, from Genesis to Revelation, a house. And what is, you know, it's a house. Yes, it's a building, but it's a house. It's a family. And so the family is in the image and pattern of God himself, who was male and female and produced life. And so now we see why the enemy is working overtime to absolutely destroy the family, because every time you destroy a family, you destroy the image of God in this world. And there can be nothing more important.
Yes. You know, it's funny, but you're saying things that Brad Scott says all the time, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I mean, he's talking about a house, a plot of land, and a family.
Yeah. I mean, that's the son. I mean, you know, God, things are deep and complicated, and at the same time, they're totally simple.
Right.
So I'd say let's just start with the totally simple and understand those things before we move on into the deep waters. So I want to look at Revelation in that same pattern of a family of, you know, the male and female producing light. And then, and seeing the enemy, you know, is constantly going to try to remove the image of God in whatever way he can find to do.
Okay.
So now, so we kind of had the mountain. I've talked about that. And so mountains become sacred spaces, and not every mountain on the planet is a sacred space, but certainly we have Mount Sinai and we have Mount Moriah. And then these sacred spaces have boundaries and divisions, just like we see with the garden. You know, there are three sort of areas outside, kind of the inner court and then the inner court, if you will. So for instance, Mount Sinai would be based on the same pattern. So where were all the children of Israel? Well, they're all at the bottom of the mountain. And then, so that's outside. And then in the midst, you know, in the inner court area, we see Joshua and Caleb, right? They're kind of halfway up the mountain or something. And then at the top of the mountain, the sages understood that the top of the Mount Sinai was a temple. That was a holy sanctuary. And so who's up there in the Holy of Holies? Well, that's Moshe. So that's always the pattern of the high priest would be come into that place, that the Holy of Holies. But that there was always a cloud, if you will, between Moshe and God. Although I know it says face to face, and that is the imagery ultimately where we are headed, but there was a cloud. And so actually one of the names of Messiah is Son of the Cloud. So he was the intermediary then between Moshe and God, and it would be the same pattern. I mean, that was the purpose of their image in their temples in the ancient Near East culture, was that image would be their intermediary between the people and the God that they couldn't reach or touch. So now one of the other aspects, the key in the temple, so you have the rock or the mountain, and then underneath you have the waters. The waters of life, which come forth from a spring, can be inside the building itself. So the temples, ancient temples, were incorporated with a spring or being built upon the spring. So we certainly see that. And actually what they tell us is that every ancient, in an ancient Near East, East cultures, there was always four bodies of water, rivers, or springs underneath the temple, underneath their temple. Isn't that interesting? When we think about the garden, which is also a temple structure,
four rivers,
because they they were, the point was the four spheres, north, south, east, and west. And that's the reason for that. See, I can't tell you. I mean, it's quite amazing. So we have, if we look at the temple in Jerusalem, we have a rock, and underneath the rock is the water. And we know in Ezekiel 47 how the water comes out from the threshold and runs down. So the rock is supposed to be like this giant plug that plugs up the waters underneath. And the sages say that the waters underneath are the waters that fill the thirst of the whole world. So like in ancient Egypt, they called it Nun, N-U-N. In Mesopotamia, it was Abzu. And in Israel, it was called Tehom, or Tehom was the waters of the deep. So the waters of the deep are kind of plugged up by the rock, you know, the foundation stone. When the rock is removed, if you will, and the waters of the deep come forth and they cover the earth, so now we have this destruction happening thing. And where they come out of is the abyss. So now we have all this discussion of abyss stuff in the book of Revelation, because it relates to, if you will, the rock being removed and then all this water coming up and everything, you know, being destroyed. So water has not only, you know, it has this destructive force, and at the same time it provides life. So it's kind of this sort of dual symbolism. So the waters underneath were said to be the sort of chaotic waters. And once creation came forth, these waters were sort of organized. But every time they come forth as destruction, it goes back to the concept of chaos. So now we see this sort of being unleashed on our world, don't we? This chaos. And that was a metaphor then for these waters coming forth out of the deep. So we're seeing the same sort of thing.
Well, it will birth the final kingdom.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what it's, I mean, ultimately that's what it's all about. Birth.
Yeah.
New life coming forth, the kingdom of heaven that's in its fullness coming forth as a birth, and the sons of God, you know. So,
you know, speaking of the abyss, by the way, you know, another reference there is, you know, it says, that the anti-Messiah will come up out of the pit, right?
Right.
And, you know, and that matches perfectly with the Islamic notion that the final imam arises out of a well, which just coincidentally happens to be the same word as pit in Hebrew.
Right. Right.
And, you know, and so that's another example of evil coming up out of the abyss.
Yeah. And it's in all the cultures. I mean, this should not be any surprise to us. You can go through every ancient Near East culture and it's the same deal. You know, once the sort of mountains removed and the waters come up, it's chaos and it's destruction. So we're not, that's what I really want to encourage people. I don't want you to drown in ancient Near East culture, but you need to have an understanding of the culture and how they thought, because really that's the time in which the Bible is written. It's written to, you know, we scientific minded folks of 2014, although spiritually speaking it is. I don't want to, you know.
Deanna, do the sages address the water source, the ancient water source for the Temple Mount?
Yes, and it is the Gihon, which actually we translate belly, but more accurately is a womb. The Gihon was actually called the fountain of living water, and that was kind of the main. But you see, we're just stuck with. So we've got the temple on top of the Temple Mount, and so therefore the water has to be immediately under that. But you have to understand the whole mountain is a temple. So the Gihon is the spring under the whole mountain. So if we take it out of its context, now we're going, well, the Gihon's down there and it can't possibly be up here and blah, blah, blah. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But the ancient thinking is the whole mountain represents the temple and the water is underneath the whole mountain. And so the Gihon is that water. And of course, that the Gihon spring is, you know, the main water supply for Jerusalem and the key to life. And so now all their ceremonies go along with that, because it's the idea of, for instance, the water drawing ceremony at Sukkot, and the water would run down from the Gihon into the pool of Shiloach, and the high priest would draw a measure of water there and then head up to the temple and pour out the water into a little basin up on the altar. But the idea of that was to return that water back to creation. That is the purpose of that ceremony. It's very interesting. And so that when they poured it out, it went down the altar and it supposedly went back to the place they called Tehom, or the deep. And there were shafts. Well, we won't get into all that. It's a little so now we have the life-giving waters. And then the next thing we have, of course, when you've got the waters, you have trees. And the trees planted in the waters because that would give life. And so, right. Of course, that's like one of the main messages of the book of Revelation, dealing with the trees planted by water that bring forth their fruit in their season. And there's 12, you know, different kinds of fruit for the healings of the nations, etc. So the river, the waters would come out literally from the throne. Trees, very important symbols in the context of the temple in ancient Near East cultures. Now, you could have a live tree or you could have an artificial tree. And so, we could go off with that, which is kind of interesting. But again, the cultic tree then would be located sort of in the center of everything, just like we see the tree of life. And they identified the tree of life with the menorah. The seven branch menorah was, you know, in the pattern and imagery then of a tree because of its seven branches.
Why do you think it is, Diana, or have you not, you know, wondered this, in the last chapters of Ezekiel, that it goes to such lengths to say, you know, at this far out, it's ankle deep, at this far out, it's, you know, up to your thighs, at this far out, it seems like there's a very gradual, is it because the nations will wash there, will mikveh there? That there's so much room, there appears to be a lot of water that is serviceable for a mikvah.
Yeah, well, and remember, it's really in some ways metaphorical language. I mean, we have to be careful about taking things way too literally. And so, you know, the essence of this life coming forth out of the temple. Now, I personally haven't given it a whole lot of thought about, you know, the various levels. And so I'm sure there's plenty in there, but we are returning then to that, the sort of cosmic temple in which everything is water and life. And so perhaps it has to the water returning, if you will. Like I said, I haven't really thought about it too much, but the water is the key to life and birth and everything else. Mm-hmm. And, so perhaps a connection there. I'm not sure. The other thing that they did consistently is that they would, their God would give their image, the image that they were worshiping, the plan and measurements of the temple. So that was completely normal. So for instance, the king of Babylon, King Nabopolassar, their temple was called Etimenanki. I don't even know if that's how you pronounce it, but something like that. Excuse me for butchering it, but he took measurements of his temple. And so this is really, this is a normal thing. They would keep the measurements and they describe the measurements as being a treasure. So now, of course, we know in Revelation 11:1, we see, you know, the measuring of the courts, outer courts, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm just trying to show you that all this imagery is alive and well in the book of Revelation everywhere. And, it's really quite remarkable.
Yeah, you know, what is really amazing is, as you're pointing out, that so much of the pattern by which things were done was emulated throughout the Middle East and throughout that whole part of the world.
Yeah, it would really help us to study it.
Yeah, and your whole point is well taken, and that is that they were emulating Abba. Emulating what he was doing.
Right.
Yes, that's right.
Their image is a dead image, and their God did not create the universe. So that's why God, over and over and over again, there's a reminder that, in fact, let me just mention this. We can read it in Revelation 14:7. It talks about the worship of the one who made heaven and earth and the sea and everything in it and springs of water. Here we go again. But that's part of the prayer service. So if you were going through this, for instance, the morning prayer service, you would read Psalm 145 to 150. Psalm 145 is actually called the Ashrei, or the Beatitudes. Oh, the joy of the man, you know, blessed is the one, blah, blah. But Psalm 146 has that very verse in it, the one who made heaven and earth and the sea and everything in it, which takes us back to Exodus 20 in the commandments of God on the sixth, on the day, the Shabbat. It tells us the same thing, who made heaven and earth and sea and everything in it. I mean, this thing is repeated over and over again. And in fact, we find examples of it in the book of Acts. In relationship to two incidents in which there was a cripple, and the verse that's given to accompany this, these cripples being made straight, is the context of Psalm 146 that talks about the lame walking, the blind seeing, the straight being, the bent being made straight, etc. But again, it reminds us about the one who made heaven and earth and the sea and everything in it. Over and over and over again, there's a reason for that. Because he is the one, you know, who created the cosmic temple, not this other guy. And so that was the constant reminder to the children of Israel. That's the pattern. Yeah.
And then that makes the whole notion of Abba not wanting Israel to emulate their neighbors all the more understandable, too, because he didn't want to look like them at all.
Exactly. And that's really the key, you know. And I think it is an important key for us today, because – unfortunately, in America today, as a community of people, and I'm not going to separate Hebrew roots from Messianic from church, but you know, as a believing community, we don't look any different.
Yeah, exactly.
If somebody landed in from Mars, they wouldn't be able to tell the difference, and it should not be. Our lives should be stunningly different.
Yes.
From everyone around us.
Well, that's the whole point of the Harbinger, which, you know, basically the Harbinger points out the fact that our punishment continues.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm sorry, but, you know, we can sit here and talk. I mean, we can talk about the fact that isn't it interesting that we're getting punished the way that they were told they would be punished. But the scary part of that is obviously we are still doing the same things that enraged him then.
Right. Well, one of the things that, and you read this certainly with the sages and in ancient Near East culture, when a temple was destroyed, chaos ensued. So we're experiencing, because the temple was the order of the whole universe. It was the structure and order and organization of the entire universe. So when it is, the temple is designed on earth as it is in heaven. So in a physical sense, purely physical sense, when the temple was destroyed, chaos came forth. Now, chaos is, you know, increasing in intensity, but it's really not a whole lot different. I mean, there are some things that look probably a lot like what it was like in, you know, the first century Rome under emperor beast worship. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
I mean, there's a lot of cutting off of heads and things of that nature. So, but it does appear to be intensifying in a way, but that again, and probably just kind of close out with this thought. So if today the body is a picture, a representation of the temple, and it's supposed to be the place of the presence of God, I think some of the chaos we're experiencing is because this body is not built. It is in division and, you know, and so the manifestation of this body being divided and, you know, not functioning as it's supposed to is resulting in the chaos that we're experiencing outside. So the only way, if you want to, you know, live in peace and grow your garden, there's only one answer, and that's repent. That's the only answer to the whole mess that we're in, because there's nothing I can do to change the government, none of that. But I can go to the altar every morning and every evening and 24 times in between, and I can repent, and that will bring the restoration and the healing of the body if everyone does it, therefore the temple, and therefore the world at large.
And, of course, you know, we as American believers have so little notion of what it means to be a body together. I mean, we talk about it all the time, but we don't get that. We don't. That's why we don't understand that we're Ephraim. Because we read, that's why we don't like to read the Old Testament, because, you know, his dealings were with the children of Israel as a group, mostly. Thank you, Diana.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much.
Yes, this stopped way too soon. Have a great week, everybody. Shalom, and we'll see you in a week.
His light now shines, the darkness must flee, Yeshua is the light of the world.